Genesis 13, and we are into the life of Abram. As you may remember, chapter 12, God makes the covenant promise with Abraham. And as we were looking in chapter 13 last week, we were looking at the beginning of the chapter where Abraham and Lot had made the decision to separate. Now, I did find this map. It may be easier than that one, I'm not sure. But here on the board, and if you remember, the area that we are really concentrating on in chapter 13 is the area here. You remember that the Sea of Galilee and then the Dead Sea down here, they were right there around Bethel, all right? And so that's when Abraham offers Lot the choice in which direction does he choose to go. He decides to go east toward the valley where Sodom and Gomorrah are. And that's where he takes his people that are with him. It is interesting. I think we kind of close on this note. Notice verse 13 of chapter 13. Even at the time Lot chooses to go there, what's the description from Moses? He describes them even at that point as a wicked people. They were great sinners. And so he chooses that. Now, one other thing I did want to note. On this map, maybe I'll use a couple different ones. On this one, we have a better, I guess, closer up of the Dead Sea. It's also called the Salt Sea. And there's some interesting kind of facts about it. The Dead Sea is, I don't think I gave you all this information last week, but it's the lowest point on the earth. I think it's like 1,300 feet below sea level. Now, we know today, what's the great attribute of the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea? It has by far the greatest salt concentration. You watch videos of people going to the Salt Sea, and it's almost impossible to sink because the concentration. And I don't understand all that biology that's going on there, but its salt content is tremendously high. Now, as we get later, maybe there's an explanation for why. But it doesn't seem, at least at this time, that it has that salt content that it will have later. But if we're looking on here, he's going to the east on this side. And, you know, later you'll have Ammon and Moab there later on. I think that's all I wanted to take from that. Any other questions about that before I move on? Okay, so I'll mention some other things. I'll come back to the Salt Sea a little bit later. But let's go to verse 14. Now, in verses 14 and following, we have God reaffirming his promise to Abram. Verse 14, the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward. For all the land that you see, I will give to you and to your offspring forever. And so if again, we are on this map, you know, you're here near Bethel. If you're looking north, what's he seeing? So he's looking up where the northern tribes settle. From north up, you know, you have Dan and Naphtali, Zebulun, all those tribes settling there later. To the south, or to the east, you'd see Ephraim and maybe Manasseh. settling there. And even, let's see, even Dan over here. I said Dan up here, but Dan down here. And then to the south, you have Judah, of course, and Benjamin, and Simeon a little further south. All of that land that he could see to the north, south, east, and west, God says, this will be yours. Now again, another interesting fact is during his life, Abraham did not own any of that, but this was a promise that would be fulfilled much later from the time he's speaking now. And so he shows him, this is finally where I'm sending you. And so there he is. In verse 16, in reaffirming the promise of offspring, so that's the land promise. Verse 16 reaffirms the offspring promise. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth. There's a couple different ways that God explains this promise. Can you think of the different illustrations God uses? Here's dust. What are the other two ways? Sand and stars, right? So if you can number those, it's the number of your descendants. So God using an earthly thing to explain what he's meaning. And so again, he reaffirms it in verse 17. It says, verse 18, Abraham moved his tent and came and settled by the oaks of Mamre. We noted that earlier in chapter 12. He had been there at the oaks of Mamre. What had he done there? Built an altar. Yeah. And so he builds another one, a second one here. It says, which are at Hebron. And there he built an altar to the Lord. And so he builds another altar there in this place that has had, or I don't know if it's currently having, but has had idolatrous worship conducted and idolatry taught. Any questions about chapter 13? All right, not a lot of questions tonight. All right, let's move on into chapter 14. And I may move through some of this kind of quickly, just for time's sake, trying to get through the book. But you have here at the beginning of chapter 14 a war that takes place between some kings from the north, some kings up here are going to come down and invade into this area. And I'm not going to get into all the different kings, but you can notice the different ones. I will note Shinar. Anybody know another name for Shinar? Or a name that will later develop? Babylon, the king of Shinar. He comes down with a group, and they go to war with the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah and some others. And so they go to war. It says, all these join forces in the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. So again, they are coming to battle down in this area close to the Salt Sea, and that's where they're going to fight. It says in verse 4 that for 12 years they had served this other king, but seems to have been a rebellion there. And so he has come down to quell that rebellion. In the midst of it, let's see. Verse 8 says that the king of Sodom and Gomorrah, those two kings came out with their other kings. They went to battle in the valley of Siddim. At the end of it, verse 11. So verse 10, end of verse 10, the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, those other kings, they're defeated. They flee. In their fleeing, verse 12 tells us, verse 11, the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. Verse 12, they also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother. Now, what brother was it? Haran. So Lot's Haran's brother. Lot's Haran's son, Abram's brother. And I don't know why, how he got involved, but somehow he did. Maybe he went to war with them. But anyway, he's taken captive. They take him away. Somehow this gets word to Abram, and we'll note his reaction. In verse 13, we have Abram referred to in kind of an interesting way, and this is the first time this term is used. But it says, then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew. First time that term is used, and from my understanding, we don't know really where that term came from. There's a couple possibilities that maybe it indicated the idea of immigrant. Abram is definitely an immigrant in this land. Remember, he came from up north, and Haran, and earlier he was in Ur. It may denote that idea. There was another one too. It may relate back to his heritage of his family line, but not really sure. Now, what's interesting is that term Hebrew becomes quite popular with the Israelite people. In the New Testament, we have a book called what? Hebrews. But here is the first time that term is used in reference to one of God's people. Again, it notes he was living in Mamre. And while there, he gets word from somebody who escaped. They get word to him. And then he gets a group together to charge out to go get his kinsmen back. Verse 14, when Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men, born in his house, 318 of them. So he goes in pursuit after him with 318 men. What does the 318 kind of tell you? Is there anything we can take away from that? Exactly. And so it speaks really to the size of Abram's company. You know, you might get the picture that you have one man under the oaks of Mamre just out there sitting by himself, but that's not true. I mean, when he comes into Hebron, he has a large company. And again, you remember part of the problem in chapter 13 was you had Abram and his company with Lot and his company, and they were so large they were beginning to infight because, you know, it's hard to care for that many people and keep the peace. Yes, ma'am.
You've got to remember, too, it's not, you know, 318 is all stretches low because that's trained fighting men.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know how many women they have, how many kids they have, how many old people they have.
Yeah, and that's. That's kind of what I was thinking was there's so many other people that were a part of his company that he's not going to take, who have not been trained or skilled in warfare. Yeah, and many of them would have been slaves. Any others? So I found that kind of interesting. It's neat to kind of, it gives you at least a picture of how large his company was. And so he gets help, but it's 318 of his own people and then some others that will come along to help. They went in pursuit as far as Dan. So again, he's going out east. Dan's out here near the plains. And it says, as far as Dan, and he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them to Hobah, north of Damascus. Then he brought back all the possessions and also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions and the women and the people. And so he goes out, he pursues them, and then strategically at night he attacks and is able to get back everything from this horde that had taken so many captives and possessions. So he's able to do that. Now, where were all the kings that had went out to war originally? What had they done? The kings of Sodom, Gomorrah, what had they done? Remember, they had fled. They had fled away. Well, after Abram is able to go out and defeat these men, he then brings back all these things to return them to those kings. It says, verse 17, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer, and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom, who went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley. And so he comes out to meet him. You can imagine how excited he is and probably humbled. And so he's coming out there to meet Abram as he returns. All of his things are coming back. And then we have the introduction of somebody new that the Bible doesn't have a whole lot to say about, but seems to be a very important figure. Verse 18. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him, blessed Abram, and said, blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And Abram gave a tenth of everything to the king of Salem. So there's a couple interesting things here that I want to note, and there's a couple other passages I would like to look at. So Melchizedek, you may know what that name literally means. You ever heard it before? The name literally means king of righteousness. It's also interesting that this king was both a king and a high priest. What's significant about being priest? Well, who was a priest? Who was a priest? Remember, this is before Levites.
Yeah, they weren't even around. So, I mean, where's this random priest in the middle of the desert?
Mm-hmm. Kind of fascinating, isn't it? How did he become priest?
Well, how did Moses?
Yeah, so let's look at a couple other passages in this connection, and then I'll give you some thoughts about this. So, there is a passage in Psalms that mentions him. If you will go to, make sure I give you the right one. Oh, where am I looking? If you go to Psalm chapter 110 and verse 4. So let's go there. Psalm 110 and verse 4. And note what the psalmist says about Melchizedek. This is a psalm of David. And you'll note that there are particular parts of this psalm that are quoted in the New Testament reflecting on Jesus. So note verse 1. The Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. All right? you go to the New Testament, Book of Acts, you'll note that that particular psalm is appointed to Jesus. Sorry, not Acts. Got that wrong. Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 13. Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 13. And then you go on later, and you go down to verse 4. In Psalm 110, verse 4, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So we have in the Old Testament, there are only two references to Melchizedek. It's in Genesis, in the text we've been looking at. And it is here in Psalm 110. And you'll note that this same text is quoted in, again, the book of Hebrews a couple of different times. So if you go over to Hebrews chapter 5, and he's brought up there, again, the Hebrews writer, quoting from this text, says, or he basically quotes that in regard to Jesus in Hebrews 5 and verse 6. Again, if you look at chapter 7, and so that's where I want to kind of go, is go to chapter 7 and to look at this particular text. He's brought up in 5. He's brought up in chapter 6. And let's go down, before we get to chapter 7, let's back up one verse into chapter 6, in Hebrews chapter 6. And notice what the text says. Hebrews 6 and verse 20, where Jesus has gone as forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Now, one of the big things about Jesus being high priest, if you're a follower of the law of Moses, what would be the problem with Jesus being priest? He's not a Levite. He's of the tribe of Judah. The priest, according to the law of Moses, was what were just the children of Levi. So Aaron could, being the first one, being in the Levite tribe. Well, Jesus, being of the tribe of Judah, according to the law of Moses, could be no high priest. So then how does the Bible make that claim? Well, the Hebrews writer says it's because Jesus falls after the order of Melchizedek. You go on into chapter 7, and it gets more into the priestly order of Melchizedek. So, verse 1, for this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, that's almost lifted, that's lifted right out of the text, isn't it? Met Abraham, returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. And to him, Melchizedek, Abraham apportioned a tenth part of everything. He is first by translation of his name, King of Righteousness, and then he is also King of Salem. Now, what's interesting about Salem is short for what? Jerusalem, right? Jerusalem, and that's where that name comes from. Notice he's King of Jerusalem. So you have King of Righteousness, High Priest, and of the Most High God, or high, a priest of the Most High God, and then you also have him King of Jerusalem. And then notice verse 3. He is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of days, but resembling the Son of God, he continues as a priest forever. And he's going to talk much more about him. If you go to the end of the chapter, he talks a little bit more about why the order of Melchizedek is better than the Levitical order. But here's this guy who just randomly comes onto the scene in Genesis chapter 14. And very, very little is said about him in Genesis 14. It does note that he blessed Abraham, and Abraham, in response, gave him a tenth of the spoils. Who is he? Well, it's hard to speak with any definitiveness. And you will see different Bible teachers and scholars disagree on this. My view of it, you study, you come up with your own view of how what you think. But he seems to be a type of Christ to come. And the reason I say that is because what's said in Hebrews chapter 7, how is he described in verse number 3? He is without father or mother or genealogy. Now, scholars are going to take that differently. And this is where you've got to do your own research and dig into the text. Is he talking symbolically without mother or father? He just simply just doesn't have a genealogy and we're not given that in any way. That's not the way I necessarily take it. I take it more literally. But again, that's something you're going to have to look into. Is it possible he is pre-incarnate Jesus? I think there are a couple other times when we see Jesus in the Old Testament. And this, in my opinion, may very well be one of those times when he's coming to bless Abraham. Also, you notice the names, King of Salem, King of Righteousness. To note somebody as being king of something is significant. Remember, biblical names have huge impact and importance in them. To be King of Righteousness, what a statement that is. And so all of those attributes are things we would label onto Jesus, definitely looking back. Those are all things that he was. So, an interesting guy, very important to us as Christians, because Jesus, the Hebrews writer, uses him in defending the priesthood of Jesus and why it's better than the Levitical priesthood. So just some interesting things. Real quickly before we close, any questions? Yes, turn.
If that were the case, wouldn't it be, you would think there's probably prophecies concerning him?
Well, I would take the Psalms passage as a prophecy, right? It incorporates him. David brings him out of, the Holy Spirit brings it into David's mind to pull him out. Well, he also occurs very early. I don't think we have to have prophecy about everything that occurs. So I don't know. I don't know that necessarily be the case. So I have to know why that would be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way some people take it. Mm-hmm. And that's the way some understand this text, and some would very much disagree with me about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the connections are just too outstanding. All right, we'll finish this up next week, get into chapter 15, looking forward. Chapter 15 kind of becomes a restatement of God's promises, so we may not spend a whole lot of time there, and we'll get on into chapter 16. Again, thank you all so much for your attention and thoughtfulness as we continue to study. As we prepare to close out, we do want to offer an opportunity for anybody who was not able to partake this morning. Before we close out, is there anybody who was not able to partake of the Lord's Supper? Okay, I'm not seeing any hands. All right, again, thank you all for being here. We're going to dismiss from this time and rejoin downstairs to do some card writing. Close us out. Vance, would you mind closing us in prayer?
Thank you all.